Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everyone. I am Lauren Tenney, and this is the Talk with Tenney show. I hope that you will call in tonight and talk about whatever's on your mind. You can reach us at area code 267-521-0167, area code 267-521-0167. If you need a toll-free line, the number to call toll-free is area code 855-346-3351, 855-346-3351. I want to remind you all about some events that are coming up. On June 19th in Brooklyn from 4 to 6 p.m., we will be holding the 6th annual vigil in remembrance of Esmond Green, who was murdered by neglect at Kings County Hospital Psychiatric Emergency Room. And that'll be at 410 Winthrop Street in Brooklyn, New York. For those of you who may not know or remember what happened to Ms. Green, she had been struggling a little. She lost her job, and she went to her pastor, and she was very upset. And her pastor didn't know what else to do, and knew that she had a psychiatric history, so she called 911, and Ms. Green was brought to the emergency room, where she was left to wait for 24 hours before she collapsed off of her chair and was face down on the floor, where security guards and other people looked at her and then rolled their chair away. The security guard, you know, sitting on a rolling chair, rolls over to the corner, peeks over, sees her, and then rolls his chair away. And when one of the psychiatric workers, when they finally realized what happened, it was because a psychiatric worker walked over to her on the floor and kind of prodded her with her foot, and, you know, which is kind of horrifying. And then when she didn't respond, they realized that that she might be dead, and she was. And it's a terrible tragedy, and you know, the idea of somebody being laying face down on an emergency room floor doesn't spark a security guard to get up and say, oh, what's going on here, really leaves one wondering what is happening in the emergency room, if that is like a standard kind of experience that people are having. That we only know about this because the Kings County Hospital Center Psychiatric Emergency was already under surveillance by the federal government, and so somebody wound up leaking the videotapes that showed this. And so June 19th from 4 to 6 p.m. will be the 6th annual vigil in remembrance of Esmond Green. And then July 11th and 12th, in Utica, New York, there will be a gathering of some people at the Alliance, the Mental Patients Liberation Alliance's headquarters, for planning and organizing activities and coming together with like-minded people. And then July 13th through the 16th, July 13th beginning at 6 p.m. and ending July 16th at 6 p.m., there will be a vigil on the sidewalk in front of the New York State Office of Mental Health for the Alliance's 34th annual Bastille Day celebration of the human spirit and to speak out against psychiatric oppression. So that we sit vigil for 72 hours because that is how long that we can be, anybody can be picked up, detained, assessed, and treated in determination for whether or not they need to be institutionalized. And so we are trying to call attention to this and other oppressive practices of the psychiatric system, including torture and what Sue Wittenberg always says is reminds me is psychiatric genocide. And so that will be July 13th through the 16th in Albany, New York. And then July 24th through the 27th in Connecticut at Wisdom House will be Mind Freedom Revolution, the Mind Freedom International's Creative Revolution Conference. And keynote speakers include Robert Whitaker and Mary Ellen Copeland, and they're going to have a phenomenal amount of information and presenters on Soteria House, coming off of psychiatric drugs, hearing voices, open dialogue, and peer respite. And that just that will be a really, really great conference at Wisdom House in Connecticut, July 24th through July 27th. And you can get more information about that at mindfreedom.org. Also, if you want to contact the Alliance about the two-day planning meeting or the 72-hour vigil, the Alliance's number is area code 800-654-7227. And then July 28th to the 31st, I believe, is going to be Youth Power is holding a Youth Power University for young people 18 to 30 years of age, where there are going to be two different course tracks. One will be systems advocacy and the other peer advocacy. And students in this Youth Power University will be dorming at St. Rose College and eating their meals at St. Rose College. And that promises to be also a great educational experience, especially for young people. If you're a young person and you want to call in, or if you were a young person in the system and you want to call in and talk about that, because I think it's one of the things we really need to educate people about of what's happening to young people, the number is area code 267-521-0167. And the toll-free line, if you need it, is area code 855-346-3351. There is a caller on the line. I'm going to open up your line. If you don't want to talk, don't talk. But if you do, just because we've been having some technical issues, your line is open if you'd like to say anything. Okay. I'm going to guess you're just listening. And if at any point you want to talk, just hit the one on the phone. You know, we've had some really interesting conversations in the last month. Today is an actual month that the show is going on, and I've been fascinated in hearing from people who are calling in and learning about all of the things that are going on and really having these conversations that can sometimes be very difficult to have. And so I want to say that, you know, because we're talking about things that very often are like hot topics, people's perspectives on them are vary widely, and especially things around when we discuss the movement itself. And so I know that it's caused quite a bit of conversation on Facebook and in other emails and other places. And I think that one of the things that we really have to look at is how do people who are in these paid peer positions that are becoming, in New York State, more like they are in other places of the country, where New York has been able to maintain them without people being certified and without it being Medicaid billable, but that's all changing in New York now. How are people going to be able to maintain the natural original intent of what peer support was about? One of the things that I realized early on was when you know, they were talking about that you can't go for a cup of coffee with somebody after hours if you're a peer support person and they're in a peer program, let alone be in a relationship with them or anything like that. And I feel like the peer services are really needing to think about what does that mean and why are they instituting this idea that we're equals when there's nothing equal about the relationship between these two groups of people. Line 303, your line is open.
Yes, Penny?
Yes, hi, this is Lauren.
Yes. Hi, and my name is Maria. I'm from Colorado, too, and Amy and I are friends. And,
hi, Maria.
I came across an email that came to my email today, and I had Amy forward it to you because I don't have your email, but it is about boys, in particular the girls, too, under the age of 24. They're testing their saliva, and the high cortisol level in the saliva is supposed to be a predetermined precursor for depression, especially if they have any of the DSM criteria for depression. They're using saliva, cortisol levels of saliva. They want to use that to say a young person is depressed. And it appalls me. That is so wrong.
That is so wrong. Maria, let me ask you, are you just on speakerphone?
No.
Okay, it's just a little fuzzy. So I was just wondering. This email, I was bad today. I was not in front of the computer all day long today.
Well, I just got it like an hour ago, anyhow, and so you might not have seen it, but it is a study they have done. And the thing is, cortisol is a stress hormone. Anybody could have high cortisol.
Right, that's what I was going to ask you. Yeah.
Yeah, and if you're testing someone who is a teenager or a young person who is just starting out in life, why wouldn't they have high cortisol levels? And then to target boys or men, you know, boys becoming men because to be vulnerable or they don't go and seek help because they're boys, and to target them as saying they're most likely to have depression if their cortisol is high. He told me any young person that doesn't have high cortisol levels.
Wow.
If any young person who is trying to make their way in their life, they're going to have high cortisol levels. And so to use that as a focus point to determine whether or not we call a person depressed or not depressed. And they also forget that, I mean, according to DSM, you have to have a persistent level of sadness. Your desire for life has got to be totally gone. You don't like to do anything that you used to like for 2 whole weeks in a row, not 2 days, then no feeling okay. Then so
this is just horrible.
Horrible. It's horrible because people are being diagnosed. And if the first line of treatment wasn't medication, I might be okay with it. But the first thing they're going to do is put them on an SSRI or some sort of antidepressants.
Which should ensure that the mass murders continue. This
right. So it's awful. And I mean, it's one of those sites that just talk about health. It wasn't even a mental health site that sent me this email, and it was like it just horrified me because just
someone
at that age that wouldn't have high cortisol levels.
Right, and I'm looking at the article, and so the future of health now .com/ separated out by dashes, a new breakthrough for depression in boys. This is really terrible. If I can just, like, let us know, I'll just read a little bit from it, and then maybe if people want to call in and talk about this. I mean, first of all, they start off by saying depression is a scourge that affects people from all walks of life, and all genetic backgrounds. See, this is how this group of scientists
right.
is trying to back off from genetics and make it about hormones, right? Because
right.
they can test hormones. And so then that counters the argument that many of us say that there's no biological evidence of any of this.
Right.
So it is impossible to calculate the dramatic effect that depression has on the population as a whole. So now they're putting it in terms of what you can't, you know, what they're, so blah, blah, blah. So depression is said to affect one in every six Americans at some point in their life before the age of 24. So it's a higher stat. It's a higher stat for young people where we don't know where they're getting these numbers from, where we, you know, is it how many people are on drugs to begin with, or is this just going to quadruple? So then they say that there is new hope, however, in predicting, right, because the four goals of psychology are to identify, define, predict, and control human behavior.
Prevent. The doctors like to prevent. It's making mental illness more common and more acceptable to the general public, and mental illness, I'm learning more and more, is a fallacy. I was never taught how to handle life under life's conditions, and when I went and sought help, I was labeled, you know, all these labels that have nothing to do with anything not knowing how to live life. But it's not something that should have ever been medicated, and I should have been taught skills from day one. But 20 years out, I've managed to learn some skills and defied all the doctors and said, take your medicine and goodbye, you know?
Yeah.
And to know that these young people are basically being indoctrinated with, you know, you're having a hard time, this is why, you're depressed. And are they giving them an adequate period of time after a life event to adjust, to learn skills, you know? You know, when someone dies, you don't get over it in 2 weeks, you know? But,
right, and now
you
under
know,
the
they
new
want to
DSM. Right, now under the new DSM, that's a psychiatric diagnosis, too, of grieving for a loved one. And so I just want people that, Maria, I really appreciate you calling in and talking. I want to just let people know, you know, read from this article a little bit. So this study was conducted by the...
I'm going to hang up and listen to you on the Internet. My cell phone has only minutes.
Okay, thanks, Maria. I appreciate
the
information. Okay, so this article, folks, and Maria, thank you, and good for you for getting out and for coming, you know, and for getting the skills that you need and doing what you got to do for yourself. And it's a real damn shame that people aren't given this, and that the first line is this biological response, which just causes more problems. So this article reads that it's conducted by researchers at the University of Cambridge. A new saliva-based test holds promise for young men, at least. It says that the test was attempted on boys and girls, but it was found to be more effective with the male test members. It involved 18 subjects, not 18 people, 1,800 subjects, not 1,800 people, between the ages of 12 and 19. So that means also that parental consent, children can't give consent. A minor can't give consent. They can only give assent. A parent can't give consent for a child. They can only give permission. And so that means that the parents or parent or in place of the parent, the state, gave permission for these things to be done to 1,800 young people between the ages of 12 and 19 through the University of Cambridge. So this research, it says it focused primarily on examining the cortisol levels through saliva tests. The researchers also had participants put together a report of depression symptoms. The subjects were then tracked for diagnoses of mental health disorders within the next 3 years. Wow. I'd like to really see the full article of this, and it seems that it was published in the proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences of the United States of America. I wonder if that's the Corporation of the United States of America. If you'd like to call in and talk about this or anything else, area code 267-521-0167. And Maria and everybody else who may be having some trouble with toll-free, there is a toll-free line. It's area code 855-346-3351. So Maria, if you want to call back in on that, please do. Or anybody else who may want to talk, toll-free, 855-346-3351. So this article in the that Maria pulled up that was in that other thing because it didn't open up into a new window, so I'm just struggling here for a second. But the article in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences of the United States of America is called Elevated Morning Cortisol is a Stratified Population Level Biomarker for Major Depression in Boys Only with High Depressive Symptoms. Ugh. And that's the title, folks. That's just the title. And this was written by Matthew Owens and, 7 other people. And the author affiliations are University Developmental and Life Course Research Group, Department of Psychiatry, University of Cambridge, Cambridge Center for Brain Repair, Department of Clinical Neuroscience, University of Cambridge, Medical Research Council, Wellcome Trust Behavioral and Clinical Neuroscience Institute and Department of Psychiatry at the University of Cambridge, the National Institute for Health Center Collaborations and Leadership in Applied Health Research and Care, University of Cambridge, and the Mental Health and Addiction Research Group. It was edited by Bruce McEwen at the Rockefeller University in New York, New York. Okay, folks, so, one of the things I always say is that we need to follow the money, and other people say this also, obviously. This is something that I was taught to look for. And so when you're looking at Cambridge University and the Rockefeller University in New York, as to who this is. So the abstract says, Major Depressive Disorder, or MD, it's kind of funny that they would let somebody have the tag MD, right? The doctors would let the people, anyway, is a debilitating public mental health problem with severe societal and personal costs attached. Around 1 in 6 people will suffer from this complex disorder at some point in their lives, which has shown considerable etiological and clinical heterogeneity. Now, I don't know where there's no citation there, so I don't know where that there's been clinical etiological and clinical heterogeneity shown. Overall, there remain no validated biomarkers in the youth population at large that can aid the detection of at-risk groups for depression in general and boys and young men in particular. Okay, so this is another fault that I have been part of. You know, you get to hear me scold myself again. This is because and sometimes when there's a response, many of us start talking about the fact that these were young, that these were all boys that were doing these mass murders. And so now boys have become an acceptable group to go after and target. And so this is dangerous because there are a lot of boys. Using repeated measures, the abstract says, of two well-known correlates of MD, major depressive disorder, quote, and then in parentheses it says, self-reported current depressive symptoms and early morning cortisol. So these are what they're saying, that they are two well-known correlates, current depressive symptoms and early morning cortisol. We undertook a population-based investigation to ascertain subtypes of adolescents that represent separate longitudinal phenotypes. And then they start to make things totally inaccessible. Subsequently, we tested for differential risks for major depressive disorder and other mental illnesses and cognitive differences between subtypes. Through the use of latent analysis, we revealed a high subtype, 17% of the sample, demarcated by both high depressive symptoms and elevated cortisol levels. So based on 17% of 1,800 kids who only some percentage of were boys, they're making these declarative statements about this kind of thing. So membership of this class of individuals was associated with increased levels of impaired autobiographical memory recall in both sexes and the greatest likelihood of experiencing major depressive disorder in boys only. Associated with increased levels of impaired autobiographical memory. Maybe like when you can't remember things, isn't that usually a sign of trauma? This is so troubling. These previously unidentified findings demonstrate at the population level of a class of adolescents with a common common physiological biomarker, specifically for major depressive disorder in boys and for a mnemonic vulnerability in both sexes. We suggest that the biobehavioral combination of high depressive symptoms and elevated morning cortisol is particularly hazardous for adolescent boys. Now, I'm just curious. There know anything about this cortisol issue and stress relation, and I'm wondering about just other hormones. If you're just 267-521-0167, area code 267-521-0167. And so I'm just right now Googling cortisol levels and puberty. And so you would think that there would be something that might be available to this. Because if cortisol is a stress hormone it's in puberty and it's in the morning and it's boys. Anybody following my train here? I think that these are just things that we need to be very concerned about in terms of then how also it's being represented to people, and this idea that 17% of a percentage of a percentage of people who participated in a quote-unquote study and so the difference between how academics write and how it's then presented in the news, it says the male participants with high cortisol levels and mild depression symptoms were found to be a whopping 14 times more likely to suffer from clinical depression compared to other teens with normal levels of cortisol. Girls with higher cortisol levels were only 4 times more likely to be diagnosed. So are they saying there's something significantly different between the, you know, this just gets into all kinds of nasty territory. They continue to say that it is likely that cortisol interacts with androgen in males differently than it does with estrogen and progesterone in females. The conclusion of the study note that this could offer up some conclusive proof that cortisol affects boys and girls differently and could potentially be used as a means of identifying people who are dramatically more likely to be depressed before the symptoms begin to actually take their toll. Up until now, medical professionals would have to diagnose depression by talking with a patient and getting the information out of them. Depression is such a scourge because so many individuals don't open up about their feelings to other people, preferring to withdraw and suffer in silence. What a So it says, thanks to studies like this, we may be able to identify those people before they begin their descent into depression to your health, exclamation point. You know, and so nowhere does it say that they have provided conclusive proof. And as a matter of fact, it says that there's a lot of maze and potentialies and, you know, could possibly in the future, but nothing current and no proof. And yet anybody who just looks at that article and doesn't really know anything about psychiatry or any of the kind of violations, human rights violations that are committed through psychiatry and what kind of torture these drugs are, and the idea that a drug can that a drug is going to fix a problem like a loss of a lost one, you know, like the death of a loved one, for example. It's just ludicrous. It's misinformation, and people are seriously being misinformed about what's happening. If you'd like to call in, the number is area code 267-521-0167, area code 267-521-0167. And if you need a toll-free line, it's area code 855-346-3351. And you know, we've seen this ideas of it's just, I'm just looking in a Google search, and this article seems to have been getting quite a bit of attention, and it can be found in many different sources, including in PubMed. This is a different article. Okay, so now this article is by Cy Seller and Jacobson, and it was published in 2013. It says, morning cortisol levels affected by sex and pubertal status in children and young adults. And so the objective, so morning cortisol levels are frequently used as screening tests for adrenal insufficiency in both adults and children. Reports differ on the specificity of this measure. This present study was to determine whether sex or pubertal status affected morning cortisol values. And so there are people who are looking at the issues of, for boys, of puberty being part of this, and ages 12 to 19 who are being affected in these ways. I mean, I think this is something that we really need to, you know, be concerned about, that they are attaching, you know, symptoms of quote-unquote depression, which they don't identify. I'm trying to figure out where they would identify what their measures of quote-unquote depression were, but that they're attaching it directly to boys, and to not address, or to not clearly anyway, address puberty inside of this as part of what is occurring, really seems to be problematic. I'm just looking at the there was a button for metrics on the article. I thought that maybe it was you know, would show what measures that they used in the testing, but all it shows is how many times the article has been downloaded. I love psychology. If you'd like to call in, it's area code 267-521-0167 and toll free 855-346-3351. Area code 970, I'm going to open your line if you'd like to talk, but just because there's been some tech issues, but if you don't want to talk. Hello?
It's Maria again. I'm using Amy's phone this time. In the article it says that high cortisol levels plus signs of the DSM signs of depression, not just the cortisol levels, but the thing is, even with the DSM as it stands today, 5, their markers for depression is too low. You know what I'm saying? to really be depressed, it's really got to be a miserable thing, not just I'm not happy, or, you know, it used to be that the everything good in life, you couldn't have anything good about life to be called depressed. Now, if you have a bad day more than once in a row, people think they may have depression, or and they refer, I'm going to go and get a happy pill, which, you know, first of all, antidepressants never made me happy.
Right.
There needs to be something else other than a pill to make you happy, but it's often referred to a happy pill. And the thing that really bothers me, like you said, is cortisol levels in two. Anyhow, but I would imagine even if they took it outside the age group of 24 and under and outside boys, I think they're targeting boys at that age because the earlier you get them, the more likely they are to in the later years. And psychiatry, right now, I mean, I left a psychiatrist because she wanted me to go on medications just to prevent. I had no symptoms. I was doing fine. She wanted me on medications to prevent a possible episode. Well, you know, life has its ups and downs. I am not going to take medicine to prevent a possible up or down because it's not going to work. Life has its ups and downs.
Right, and that's just criminal to be adding these poisons into the bodies of anybody, but particularly young people, as the idea that it could quote unquote prevent it, when all of their evidence says they have no idea of how it happens and it winds up doing damage to 2/3 of the people that are on it, and even the people who are voluntarily taking it still have these side effects. So it does side effects in terms of bodily injury, and they're not side effects, they're injuries that are caused by this. But the other thing, Maria, is that 12 to 19, I don't know about you, but...
That's awful young.
Those years are just adolescence. It is the just developmentally, it is one of the most difficult times. And if you've got 1,800 young people in this study who parents have given permission to be test subjects, things can't be that good to begin with. Do you know what I mean? Or the state, or whatever province or whatever in who is giving permission for these children to be research subjects? It's just so problematic. And so you add things in like that first relationship, the first big breakup, the first, you know, big time that you failed something in school, you know, the first this, the first that, the first the other thing, and you take one of these tests, you know, that are totally subjective.
No, that's Penny, though. The thing is these when they search for research people to volunteer for research, what do you see in the paper? Depression study. Never. You don't need to be diagnosed. You're having a hard day. You know, you think you might be depressed. So they're getting people who are having problems in the first place, and they either don't know where to go to get help, or this is their inroads to getting help, or who knows what, whether it be a private pay or public mental health. It's an inroads. So these people are looking for help in the first place because the way they advertise these depression studies is like a free way to get help. So they're soliciting people who don't have any means to get help. This is
very
a quick,
important.
Free way to get help. And then these people are already going to have high cortisol levels because life under stress gives high cortisol. So to say that high cortisol levels is going to be an indication of more likeliness to be depressed is absurd if you just think about, you know, and just don't take it at face value. You think about, I happen to know what cortisol levels are, okay? But Amy didn't know. She goes, what is cortisol? I said, it's a stress hormone. So you tell me anyone that isn't under stress.
Right, and they actually advertise about cortisol levels in a lot of diet products in the U.S.
Right.
And that it's associated with belly fat, they say.
Right.
And so they're selling all of these other pills to people to be taking this. But one of the things that concerns me in this article is that it says the researchers also had the participants put together a report of depression symptoms. The subjects were then tracked for diagnoses of mental health disorders within the next 3 years. What if the researchers had them put a report together of things they were proud of, or things that were good in their life, or, you know, or whatever. You know what I mean? Like, even say, just so from the very start, they're asking these kids to talk about when they're, so to expect that a young person or any person wouldn't be sad at different points in their lives, wouldn't feel hopeless, wouldn't feel that, you know, life is too much, that things are too hard, that, you know, they'd be, you know, better off if they were somewhere else or somebody else.
I know growing up at that age, I had all those symptoms. My very first thought of suicide was when I was 16. I just had an operation. I almost died of appendix. No wonder I didn't know how to handle that. My family didn't know how to handle that, and I got depressed and suicidal. I didn't tell anyone then because I was scared to talk about it then. It was not until I was 28 that I went to get help for suicide, but it, in my mind, at 28, suicide was a mental illness. It wasn't a normal, everyday occurrence that can happen to anyone who's had a bad thing happen to them, and that's exactly how it started. I had something bad happen to me. I was never taught how to handle adverse effects in my life, and you know, I was thinking about, you know, why being alive? But that my limited knowledge was suicide meant you were sick, and I wasn't going to let anyone know until I thought I had to let someone know. But I was 28 at the time. I wasn't a teenager. But today at 51, I know, oh, that idea just came in my head. I'm kicking it out. I don't need to think that way. And that's just another thing. That's just a fact of life. And I truly don't, I mean, not everyone acts on suicidal thoughts. I completely understand that. But I think everyone at some point in their life, maybe not suicide like I thought of suicide, but, oh, my life would be better if I wasn't alive or if I never existed. Who hasn't thought those things? But in my young life, my young mind thought, oh, that makes me sick, and I don't want to be labeled as a sick, mentally ill person. And I ended up that way anyhow. But today, I'm trying to shake that. I totally left a big city, moved down to the country, and I don't even want anyone to track me in any way, shape, or form. When I go to a new doctor, I'm not going to tell them my mental health history. And hopefully they don't find out because I'm on Medicare, you know. But I don't want people knowing my history anymore. And there was a time where I walked around saying, I'm bipolar, until someone said, you know, Maria, you might have that diagnosis, but you're not a typical bipolar, and you probably shouldn't be telling people you're bipolar because it gives people the wrong idea. That was someone who wasn't mentally ill who said that. But you know, I identified with being mentally ill for years, and now I'm trying to say, no, that's a lie. I didn't know how to handle life. I know how to handle life now. Please don't put me in that box. Please don't treat me like I am unable to think for myself just because I have this horrible diagnosis of borderline personality. I mean, it's crazy. And I won't stand for it anymore.
Well, good for you, Maria. And I think that these kinds of things, and you know, you certainly have survived quite a bit in your life. And the other side is that people are never given any validation for the things that they have been through and what has been gone. And if people around you don't know how to handle life either, but have, you know, put on some kind of mask that they've got it together, you know, when you're a child growing up in these situations and you don't know what you're doing and nobody around you knows what they're doing, it just becomes even more complicated. And I'm sorry, but I also think that there's something so important that you said around, you know, the doctors and not wanting doctors to know, and the dangers now with the electronic medical records where everything is available to any doctor you go to, and it's just
right
there. And so immediately
where I am, they don't have those yet.
Right, right. But unfortunately, under the Affordable Care Act, you know, in going forward, and who knows what they're going to do, because medical records are such a joke anyway. When you read them, it's like, who are they even talking about? You know, they're not necessarily.
Well, Kenny, I had the privilege of seeing some of my records, and the therapist used to put in my records, the patient wasn't wearing her dentures today. She says she has a sore. Why would you even put that in a mental health record? because I didn't wear my dentures. You write a note like there's something wrong with not wearing your dentures one day. I did have a sore. So why would you even put that in unless you're taught that a person's appearance, you know, and if the only thing you could find wrong with my appearance is that I wasn't wearing my false teeth that day, then you've got a problem, not me, because I've always looked like any other person on the street. I did not have that, you know, dazed look, or that I didn't sit there talking to yourself, or, you know, even with medications, the doctors would say, you don't appear like, and I'm telling you, if I ever hear this again, I'm going to scream. You are very intelligent. A psychiatrist, all of them have said, Maria, you're very intelligent. And I always just think, what, only mentally incompetent people are, I mean, do I have to be a lack of intelligence to be mentally ill? You know?
Yes, I'm
intelligent, but that doesn't mean I, you know, intelligent people can have difficulties in life either. You know, it's just like,
right.
IQ's pretty high.
It's another judgment call that you know, everything is value based, and one of the people,
and subjective.
Yeah, and you know that this is part of where you start to, one of the people who participated in D-Voice, Nathan, said this is where you start to feel like you're property, because everything is, no, you could do better than that, you're smarter than this, you should know better, you know what I mean?
Right.
And it's like, this is emotional, this is trauma, this is things that have happened to a person throughout the course of their life that have caused them emotional strife and difficulty.
They say that it's a brain imbalance, a chemical imbalance in your brain.
Yeah.
So if your brain is chemically imbalanced, how could you be intelligent and have emotional problems at the same time? So, you know, the brain chemistry is giving signals that it's out of whack, but how could you be intelligent and have out of whack brain chemistry? It's the fact that it's not a brain chemical problem. It's you know, I was abused as a child. I was told I was no good, ugly, I mean, just the whole thing. And my dad made my whole family believe it. And thank God he put people in my life that said, Maria, you're beautiful, and you're smart, you do good things, because I didn't get that growing up. And so now I believe it. You know, when I finally met people that gave me kudos when I didn't grow up with kudos, and it's just getting out there and meeting the right people that can change your whole life. And to
right.
be told it's not okay to have been abused. It's not okay that someone told you were no good, because you are good, even if you don't feel like you're good. You know, and it's that simple. It doesn't have to be this brain chemistry. I mean, you'd be told almost every day in your informative years that you're no good, you're unacceptable. You're going to believe it when you're 25, you know?
Right.
So it's
and
some chemical in my brain.
Right, and so there's no evidence of it, and that there's that there are these evidence of these real painful experiences that people have gone through, and the conditioning that you get as a child, the messaging that you get, if all you're ever told is no, or all you're ever told is you must look this way, or you must do this, or you must do that, and there's no acknowledgement about what you are doing, and all you're getting is negative messages about yourself, it's very hard to not have those types of messages come forward and to replay in your own head as an adult. And so, you know, sometimes voices that people hear are these exact messages that they were told all throughout their formative years as children that are then replaying to themselves because they've been conditioned to do these things. And so the misinformation that society has given about these chemical brain imbalances and now these cortisol levels. And I'm sorry, I wish if you're a man and you're out there and you want something to say about what early morning cortisol and early morning stress, you know what I mean? Like going through puberty, I don't know much. I'm a woman. I don't have this personal experience of being a man. But I'm kind of sure that like there's like a lot of stuff going on with a male's body from 12 to 19 years old. And if you're getting messages about what is good or bad or a sin or evil or, you know, any of these other things, I'm sure that this is increasing your stress. And I'm sure that, like, you know, being a sexual being and developing one's sexuality in an environment that is sexually repressive adds some level of stress. Area code 609, you're on the line?
Yeah, this is Jason from New Jersey. I tuned in a little late, but I heard you reading the last part of that study. I guess that's a new study, just came out or just became available or someone pointed it out to you. I don't know. But
Maria called in to point it out, and it looks like it's just come out.
Well, they've got, you know, yeah, I mean I can't really say for myself now, but the population, you know, I mean that's a vulnerable age for anyone, male or female, and I don't know where they're, you know, I don't know anything about the study, but I'm thinking about psychiatry and how they're just looking to legitimize what they're doing. And they're looking for, you know, a biomarker or something like a blood test, like a swab that they can conveniently use to target people. Really, you know, it's just another. I'm sure there are lots of other studies like that, you know, where they're looking, digging for something. And you also mentioned the Rockefellers and the big money that's behind that. That's a good. Indication. It reminds me of eugenics and what they did in this country, and how all the there was a lot of big money in that. You know, the big names, the big names in industry supported, and also the Ivy League schools were supporting research into eugenics. It reminds me a little bit of that,
I mean this targeting and of males, and then putting young boys on psychiatric drugs preventatively.
I mean, what are these drugs? You know, the psychiatric drugs that are available, that they use for depression. You know, how are they going to affect cortisol? I mean, if it really is a cortisol problem that's causing the depression, you know, do they have drugs that can somehow, you know, alter the hormone output or something like that? And if they do, then the problem solved. Why, you don't need a psychiatrist then, you know? Say, and if they give, they're going to give these dangerous drugs that, you know, alter brain chemistry. And
right,
I know that, you know.
Brain and body.
And body chemistry.
I mean, in terms
and body
the sexual side
true.
Effects. In terms of the sexual side effects on the SSRIs, this is, you know, and if puberty is part of what's causing the stress to then suppress somebody's capacity to have an orgasm
or
an erection or anything like that. Like, this is all, I mean, and so then you say genocide, and it's like, well, yeah, it's like a form of sterilization if you're putting, like, young men on a drug that prevents them from being able to be sexual. Like, it's...
You know, I went through that in my, you know, late teens. I was put on the drugs, and, you know, I was not sexually active, you know, because of it. I mean, I had no, not too much desire for anything,
And they're good with that. They're good with that because they don't want us to reproduce. They don't want us to have families and to have full lives and to have the things that anybody who hasn't been assigned gets to have, regardless of what it is they're doing. And so I feel like these are major issues. And I also feel like this targeting of boys, there's a subliminal message that's going through because they keep on pushing that it's, you know, young males that are doing the mass murders, that, like, subliminally in people's minds, they've been so conditioned of this that this is good because this will stop the mass crime.
We can start targeting people before they even show these, you know, so-called symptoms of mental illness or depression just by checking for higher cortisol levels. It's ridiculous.
Which is the same thing. I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, that's all. I mean, it's just, you know, and all the language, you just mentioned that, how they use this pseudoscience language, you know, no one can understand it. It's just crazy stuff. It's really wacky, crazy, out of control stuff. That's going to lead to, more harm on a massive scale. You know, it's unbelievable that all these people are involved in this research at, you know, Cambridge or wherever these studies are coming from.
Cambridge and the Rockefeller University in New York, and so there, you know, there's that other little clip that we can't forget about, but. You know, that now, thanks to Jared and Amanda Miller, if you mention conspiracy, now you're also targeted for being somebody who can do this. Like, it's ridiculous. And so I'm just finding this article on JanetHull.com. She's a doctor of alternative health and nutrition, and she's referring to that commercial. There's a commercial that says... you know, cortisol, that nasty hormone level that creates belly fat. Her title of her article is Cortisol is Not a Nasty Little Hormone. And she says, there's a new television advertisement promoting a revolutionary product that suppresses cortisol for weight loss. The ad refers to cortisol as a nasty little hormone that creates fat around the stomach and hips. By taking their, quote, weight loss pill, cortisol is suppressed and weight loss occurs just like that. Oh, but there's a catch. She continues to write, cortisol is not a nasty little hormone, and by suppressing it, the body's immune system can become seriously depressed and its hormonal balance severely knocked out of balance. Before any one hormone is ever altered and or suppressed, a hormone analysis should be performed so all hormones are regulated and balanced synergistically. It says that cortisol is a steroid hormone made in the adrenal glands, which are small glands adjacent to the kidneys. Cortisol is released in the body during stress, hence it is called the stress hormone. It says, but cortisol is more than a simple marker of stress levels. It is necessary for the function of almost every part of the body. And so they are going to be screwing with something and trying to attack something that is involved with every aspect of the body's regulation and management here.
Right. And I sometimes forget, too, that, you know, these drugs, how they really do, you know, affect every organ system in the body and do damage, and I forget that because there's so much focus on the brain and everything, but the damage is widespread, and it's throughout your, you know, the body, and also the chemicals. I know that that serotonin and norepinephrine. I mean, these bodies are not just in the. I mean, these chemicals aren't just in the brain. They're in the body. You know, they're a lot of them are in the. You know, throughout your body. Yeah, I mean, they're not just brain chemicals, right?
Right. And there was a new study that I saw recently that they said that they think, you know, I don't think this was conclusive, but they think that serotonin is actually produced in the stomach. And so,
yeah.
they really don't have a clue as to anything that they're talking about. And, like, honest doctors will admit that. But unfortunately, they're few and far between. But the other thing that Maria, if you're still listening and you want to call back, I'm not sure what happened. I hope I didn't accidentally cut your line off. But if you want to call back and talk about this article about the boys' cortisol levels is definitely troublesome. And they said that they were looking at the cortisol levels. I'm sorry, I lost the spot on the page, but where they're testing these, I believe in the morning, and the article by Dr. Janet Starr-Hull says that cortisol is usually highest in the morning, but in addition to early morning, cortisol levels may also be highest after meals. And so, you know, you don't even know what the conditions were that they were being tested for and whether or not there's, you know, but for psychiatry to be playing around with hormonal imbalance and starting to craft off different types of courses for boys and girls based on testosterone, progesterone, and estrogen, this is also deeply problematic because this is how they start to actually alter our sexual systems. This is how, you know, and people should be very concerned about this because it's never just as simple as it seems. You know what I mean? And it's never just straightforward as to what it is they're trying to do. And the idea
well,
that depression.
I was put on lithium at 18, and after a year of being on that, it affected my thyroid. I became hypothyroid, so I was put on Synthroid, and I've been taking that ever since. I don't take psychiatric drugs anymore, but I still take my Synthroid, which was a direct, result of, you know, damage to my thyroid from taking a popular drug for, you know, mania. So it suppresses.
Which drug? There's a correlation between
lithium and the thyroid.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh,
it happens to a lot of people. I had no idea at the time. I found that out later, but it's a pretty common thing when you've been started on lithium that at some point, if you continue to take it, your thyroid's going to stop producing the hormone. You'll become a, you know. And also, you know, if you do have a thyroid problem, if you're hypothyroid, if you have hypothyroidism, you can feel depressed or slowed down, and a lot of times, just correcting that will lift your mood. And they never check for that. A psychiatrist, you know, I've never been to a psychiatrist who's ordered medical tests or anything other than blood work to check to see if I'm toxic from the drugs they're giving me.
Right.
This
also happened to me. I have in my when I got my medical records after HIPAA was passed, and I suggest everybody go get a copy of their medical records and go through it. And
yeah.
Deb Schwarzkopf's ectjustice.com has a lot of really great tips on how to get your medical records and what you should be asking for. For electroshock, but just in general to get them. I found tons of pages of blood reports checking the levels of the drugs that I was on when I was 15 years old, locked up.
Mm-hmm.
And the very first one, though, had something on my chart circled and out of range and initialed. and not one follow-up test for it. And years later, in like 2007, an oncologist told me I was lucky that they didn't go after it because I had the same issue. Said that they were lucky that I was lucky that they were incompetent, because at the time the treatments probably would have killed me. And so, but the denial, like, I'm pretty sure that if people thought that I had some kind of physical illness, they wouldn't, or the goons wouldn't have been allowed to throw me out of bed in the morning when I couldn't wake up. Like, I'm pretty sure my entire experience in life would have been different if things that happened to me while I was institutionalized at this, you know, 15 years old didn't happen the way that they happened. And I think that on top of all of the trauma or abuse or just pain that people are coming into the system with, there's then having to recover from what happens to you once you get in to this quote-unquote help. And Jason, you talked really deeply about what's happened to you in the past, and I appreciate you sharing it, because people who are listening to know that they're not alone and that there are ways out. And like Maria was saying, that, like, you know, she's learned the skills she's needed now, but no, you know, no help from the system. They don't help us. And so,
well, yeah, and they're going to, and being on these chemicals and experiencing the system, you know, it really, it prevented me, I know, and it prevents other people from learning to, you know, to grow, adapt, or to change or learn healthier ways to cope with life and, you know, in creative ways. It really does.
It's devastating life. And so when, you know, when, like, if you look all the way back to even Irving Goffman's Asylums, where he talked about this two-stage process that the system uses to turn a person into a mental patient, you know, that, and he was talking about adults, what happens when we start doing this to children before they even know how to talk? You know, you've got these kids who are 0 to 3 years old who are being psychiatrized, three-year-olds being put on Haldol. If you look at, like, Rebecca Riley's situation, at 2 diagnosed, at 4 dead, psychiatrist gets, I want to say immunization, but that's not probably the right word. The psychiatrist gets protected
immunity,
in the court case.
Yeah.
Immunity, yeah, thanks. And the parents go to jail.
The parents were held responsible for these irresponsible, mad doctors. And I think about it now. You know, I know that I think that, you know, it's like, you know, your brain isn't fully hasn't fully matured until you're like 25 or something. I think that's about average. I was put on these drugs when I was 18, you know. So I factor that into my own, you know, when I'm thinking about all the damage and all the stuff that I've been through, all the trauma that, you know, I was duped into participating in. That's just another thing. Now they're doing it to people younger and younger. It's really, really bad. It's evil. It really is.
It is evil.
I think after the electroshock, I mean, I started to read about evil. I read Zimbardo's books. I started to think about evil. It started this whole new kind of philosophical outlook for me. You know, this is just like, and I never thought about that before. I'd never given it much thought. It's just pure evil. It's like, I think about it all the time.
It is. It's social control, and it's that great economic and social profit for those who are in power here. It's not just economic power. It's the social power that they get. It's the accolades. It's the prestige that how they get to walk around in the world. You know, and it's the economics helps, but it's not just that. It's that these people are then hailed and looked at as
leaders
and you know, brilliant people who must be applauded. And if anybody tries to interject some opinion other than the one that they're spouting,
mm-hmm.
calling it science, they're then made to be not credible or just completely
mm-hmm.
isolated out from any future conversation. And
mm-hmm.
that is so problematic in so many ways. And I know there are people who may be listening who are going through this kind of experience. And if you want to call in, the number is area code 267-521-0167, area code 267-521-0167. And if you need a toll-free line, the number is 855-346-3351, 855-346-3351. I also want to just tell people that my email, if you want to email me directly, and Maria, if you're still listening, thanks so much, and please feel free to call in now or anytime. My email is My email is laurentenney at AOL.com, and my Twitter is lauren10e, and that's my Twitter handle, laurentenney, the number 10, letter E. And Jason, I wanted to let you know that on the Facebook page, I did put out a post last night saying if anybody had experience with bilateral electroshock.
Thanks. It's not bilateral. It's called bifrontal.
I think I put I think I put bifront. Oh, let me see. What did I put?
Bilateral. Yeah.
No, I did. I put bifrontal. Are you a survivor of bifrontal electroshock? Someone is looking to connect to with others who were subjected to it.
Oh, thank you.
I've gotten two responses already.
Really?
Yes. And one of them is George Ebert of the Alliance, and you can reach
mm-hmm.
him at area code 800-654-7227.
Okay.
And then there are several other people, so I'm going to try to put you all in contact with each other.
Okay, good. So that's can you give me those last four digits? 654-800, that's the Alliance.
Oh, it's area code 800. The Alliance's phone number is 800-654-7227.
Okay.
And George said he thought bilateral. I'm sorry, I'm misreading. I misread it. But there are people who said that they had it or think they had it, and so I'll put you in connection. But George would be a good person for you to be in touch with anyway. He's phenomenal.
I mean, yeah. Okay. I'll call. A lot of times people can't remember what they've had. You know, they only find out after they see their records or someone tells them. And if there's no one to tell them, they can't even remember how many they've had. And after some years, you know, they may forget. I don't know.
Right. and I think that there's definitely also misinformation that's given to people about what it is they're getting and such. But I do think that this is connecting people is part of, I think, what works, and for people to know that there are so many people out there who have had these experiences. There are millions of us. There are tens of millions of us. And that we can come together and connect in ways. There are a couple of people who are holding on the line. And so if you want to talk, just press 1 at any time. And if you're a first-time caller and you want to talk, the toll-free number, again, is area code 855-346-3351. And so, Maria, if you're listening out there, thank you for calling my attention to this new study about the cortisol and depression. I mean, how do you adequately take a quote-unquote depression screening? And then how do you, with any kind of character as a human being, turn these experiences that people have, whether life-threatening emergencies or abuse or trauma or rape or loss of a loved one, or even for a young person, a loss of a pet, or for anybody really, it's such a traumatic experience to lose a pet. And then how do you then say, oh, well, this is just a function of a chemical imbalance or a hormone level being out of whack?
Well, you know,
and train
also,
people to take drugs.
Yeah. And also, when you go to see a psychiatrist now, you know, with a 15-minute med check and,
what's a 15-minute med check?
You go back in to see them, and you're not, you know, you may or may not be given you don't really talk to anyone about what's going on in your life anymore to a psychiatrist. They may or may not tell you to see a therapist. They may or may not do that. But, you know, when you see a psychiatrist, you're in there for 10 minutes, 15 minutes, you know, after some initial assessment where they give you, forms like the depression surveys, whatever they are. I know I've taken them and other things like that. But, you know, now they're concentrating on, you know, what they call symptom relief. So that's all they're doing. I mean, they don't.
Is that like pain relief, like pain management relief?
Yeah, it's kind of like that's kind of what it's like. So you go back to see them and they say, you know, how do you feel, da-da-da, what are your symptoms, you know, and this is the language that people learn to speak once you're a patient. And,
right, because they're turning you,
know, you
into, like Goffman said 50 years ago, they're turning you into a patient.
You're
indoctrinated into how you're supposed to respond. You learn very quickly as to what not to say because of the responses you get back, right? conditions, and you're conditioned by punishment and reward, and the reward is not being punished. That's how it snaps up. And so in 15 minutes, and so this can go on for years or decades.
Yeah, it can go on for years, decades, yeah, easily. Because, you know, everyone around you, your family learns to treat you a certain way and expect that you have to go see your doctor once a month or every 2 weeks, whatever it is. Sometimes once, you know, every 6 months to have your meds adjusted. And if you're having start expressing, you know, too much pain or complain too much, then you have to, you know, go into the hospital to have your meds readjusted. You know, they ask you that all the time, and that's all it is. And you'll hear them say, you know, well, you know, we're really just looking at symptoms, you know.
Point is, like, the social construction of this capitalistic society that we're subjected to taken into account. And I'm sorry, there are some adults who don't even, like, really think about or know it.
Mm-hmm.
Somebody shared something on Facebook about what a genius marketing executive, how they manipulate people into accepting things. And so it was like using the right imagery and the right words. And then the third thing, and she called it the secret weapon, was the person themselves who's watching the advertising and their willingness to ignore reality and their willfulness to ignore reality and to not want to be bothered by the reality of things. And that it's the people that make that third connection in the marketing scheme of that, I don't really want to pay attention to what the reality is. I'm just going to look at these nice, pretty things. And
right. The marketers know what to put out. They know all the hooks. So,
right, because a lot of them are psychologists.
And you don't know
As a young person growing up, of all the magazines and everything else that you're looking at and the television and the movies, that this is just not reality and these are not the standards that real people are like. And if all you know is a small group of people that you've been traveling with, you know, through school, and that's all you know of who people look like, and adults are foreign to you because you're a young person and it's just a different, you know, you're seen as a second-class citizen to them, like, you don't understand that this is what's really going on and that it's all a scheme to get people to be unhappy. You know, if you don't know that the average person doesn't look like whoever they're calling, you know, the top supermodel this week, and that's what the standard that you're expected to live up to, which is totally unrealistic, that's enough to make a person sad. You know, it's just, you know, if you're growing up and you're a young boy and cortisol levels stressed, right, and you're seeing what it is a quote-unquote man is supposed to be and you're nowhere near that because it's not reality-based, you know, then you develop this hostility and hatred toward everybody and everything like Elliot Rodger did. Like, that this is, this is, and you can't fix, even if you can fix a hormonal issue, which to me is still questionable as to whether or not what the long-term effects of that kind of thing is, you know, it still doesn't resolve the emotional problem that people are having, the stress, the experience, and the idea that people can be sad. Like, you know, you have a right to be sad if you're sad about something. And finding people who support you is the key, not people who are going to tell you that you're crazy and you need to be drugged. Area code 484, your line is open.
Yes, my name is Raymond. I'm a career specialist.
Hi, Raymond.
Yes.
Hi.
I just got off my shift and wanted to be opened. I think it seemed like there had been some questions about working as a peer specialist.
Yeah.
And the comment was that I guess that many peer specialists aren't too clear about what they actually do. So, or that they're reluctant to talk about what they actually do. So, but I'm always the one to talk about what I do. So,
great.
And if you...
Well, thanks for calling. And so I'd love to hear what you have to talk about and what you want, you know, what do you do?
Well, I currently work as a... in Philadelphia as a mobile peer specialist. And as of last year, our program became Medicaid billable. And what was interesting is that originally I thought that would have been a great idea, becoming billable, because that would give some sort of importance to what I do, because I have worked.
I hear that.
Because I worked as as an ACT team, where I was working as a case aide, and it never seemed that whatever I wanted to do was as important as what was scheduled with the case managers.
Right. You know, I'm just going to interrupt you for a second. Do you know one of the old slogans of the movement is, "I'm not a case and I don't need to be managed"? Have you ever heard that slogan before?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yes, I heard that. As someone who had a case manager, you know, I really didn't like that term at all, because it just seemed like whatever my issues were, what my needs were, was being defined as someone who had issues that is never going to get anywhere in life, and it really bothered me.
Yeah, it should bother you. That's a terrible thing to have gone through. So let me just understand that. So before it went Medicaid billable, you were hopeful about it because you thought it would validate the position in some way, and the case managers and psychiatrists and psychologists and all would view you differently?
Right, yeah. Far as even as far as being able to schedule and do the things I wanted to do, I thought it being billable would validate that. As well as validate the position.
Mm-hmm.
But what I found out since is that, first of all, I always used to believe that the system, and I'm talking about medical as well, is that they're about continuity of care. Like, when someone is coming out of the hospital, there should be some sense of being able to support that person, or have things set up for them for when they are living on their own out in the community.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. As in supporting them from going from one supporter to another. I use that term instead of using the medical profession, clinicians.
Oh. Okay.
But what I found out is that because it's now billable, it's who's paying. And, you know, and no one's going to double bill, even though it's, like, for instance, I was supporting someone who went from one residential program to a different one.
Mm-hmm.
And somewhere along the line, he had medical issues, as in he and just a side note, I've discovered that it seems that maybe a large percentage of the people I am seeing as a peer specialist, oddly enough, seem to have issues regarding diabetes, type 2 diabetes.
That's
because
the drugs cause it.
Mm-hmm. And I seem to, no one seems to think that's a big issue. And,
that's horrible. What a crime.
And it is taken as, he's got type 2 diabetes. And I'm thinking, why? There should be a concern about why this is happening. So in this case with this gentleman, he had untreated diabetes, and it affected, he had open sores in his feet.
Oh.
And he ended up going back in the hospital with it. And because of me being, my service being billable, as soon as the insurance got dropped, I was no longer able to see him.
This is where the fraud comes in, right?
Mm-hmm.
That we're peers.
It's an obstacle. It's like an obstacle. The fact that you know, it's an obstacle to you actually being able to help this person when you think you can. And you want to.
Right. I couldn't go there.
Yeah.
Right. And now if what I did had just remained as a program funding, whereas the agency I worked for would have gotten the funding at the beginning of the year sort of thing, there wouldn't have been a question about me continuing to see him.
Right. For the position versus the billable hours. Like, this is awful. Raymond, I thank you for calling in. Because, like, New York hasn't gone here yet, I'm not even really aware of what anything is going to look like in practice. And we've been fighting it off for years. Even accreditation, we were pushing for accreditation of organizations, not of individuals. But even that's been lost. And so the formalization of it, how it detracts from the true nature of mutual support, is really, really highlighted here. And then this other issue about where, so you're still not able to, you know, say, like, this is what I want to do, or this is what needs to be done, or, you know, you're still, you know, underneath the case managers and the psychiatrists and all these other people on the
well,
quote-unquote
yeah.
team, right?
And what also is interesting is that regarding HIPAA, I've had my peers sign the releases and do all the right things. And it is just common now. We just know it happens on a regular basis where we're notified, we're not told about, we go out to see someone and they're not there. And we make inquiries. And no one really comes out and lets us know that, so-and-so is back in the hospital. Okay. It's like, well, I just drove out here. It just took me an hour to come out here on my schedule. only to come out here to find out that the person I'm coming out to see is no longer here because he was admitted in the hospital on Friday. And you guys didn't feel it necessary to let me know. Even though I've had him sign all the releases, consent for emergency contact, what have you. So, it's interesting, this whole thing regarding needing to expand the HIPAA laws. Frankly, I think not enough agencies are want to be knowledgeable about what that actually implies.
Right, and that's all part of the Murphy Bill, H.R. 3717, right, of where they're trying to make.
Right.
And so HIPAA never protects the actual person who's the quote-unquote patient. It just, you know, protects everybody else from, and that person from ever really knowing what's going on with their life and their records.
Right.
And it's,
exactly.
I think, you know, it's a hard, you know, there's so many other issues of what it means to be on a mobile crisis team or what it means to be somebody, you know, how are you a quote-unquote peer if you're involved with a group of people who are potentially about to take this person to an institution or, you know, like these kinds of hardcore issues that the movement has been dealing with for decades now, right? But then the complication comes is that people are betrayed because they're told that this is going to make them be able to have more access and do more of the kind of work that they think that they're doing and truly being a support and trying to provide alternatives and help people get out of the system. And then they wind up just, you know, totally being disregarded, having all kinds of financial implications, I'm sure, because if you have to bill by the hour or whatever instead of, like, you have a salary, like, this is an entirely different turn-up of how it is that, you know, a natural peer support program versus a billable service would work.
Right.
And I'm very worried about what's going to happen to New York because our industry, the peer industry here is huge. There are, like, thousands of people who work in this industry who are now going to be subject to this, and it's really a problem. If Raymond and Jason,
yeah,
if you stay on the line, I want to bring in area code 646. Area code 646, your line is open.
Hey, Lauren, how are you? It's Les.
Hey, Les, how are you doing?
All right.
Good.
This whole thing with the peer specialist stuff or the roles of peers, I think it is a you know, everybody wanted national health care. Well, this is a consequence of it. And, you know, I think when we're talking about roles on peers on mobile crisis teams, I have some experience with that. And in a project like Parachute, for example, where there's supposed to be, there's a certain amount of liability built into the project. If you have a mobile crisis team like the one at HHC that's so liability-focused, that's the only thing they think about is liability, not the person, you're screwed 10 million ways from Sunday. You really can't do the work that you're supposed to do as a peer specialist on the Parachute team, at least at HHC for that particular reason.
I understand what you're talking about, but for those who may not know, in terms of liability, what do you mean liability?
In other words, somebody says that they're going to hurt themselves, and you have a conversation with them, and you are able to, quote-unquote, make a pact with them that they're not going to hurt themselves, and if they are, they're going to call you. And instead of letting the person and trust the process that they're going to, you know, keep their word to you, instead of that, you worry about the liability of being sued, and you lock them up right away. That's the legal liability.
Because you're on a team that you don't have control over, because there are professionals there who are, so you're not really doing quote unquote peer work. You're part of a team that is about to institutionalize somebody. So people must understand that the standard for being committed is danger to self or others, or perceived danger to self or others. It's not even in the new version of Kendra's law that they're trying to push forth in New York. It's not even suicide anymore. It's just bodily injury. And so that can be seen as anything. That is just,
well, and that's problematic, because with parachute in New York City, there's a certain amount of liability built into the model.
So what does that mean? There's a certain amount of liability
because in the respites, people are supposed to be able to go in and out 24/7. So let's say you're in a respite and you start having some thoughts or some feelings or whatever. The idea is to help you work through those feelings and talk about stuff in a different way. That's why everyone who's on a parachute team, whether it be a mobile crisis or as a peer respite worker or a staff member, licensed clinical staff member at the respite, has supposed to have taken the 5-day IPS training, the intentional peer support training, where you're supposed to learn how to talk about self-injury, people who experience things that most of us don't, suicide, all these other things. You're supposed to learn how to talk about them differently. Now, I was fired from a mobile crisis team because I was on HHC's team, okay? And when I was asked, I had a conversation with a gentleman in a respite where I was asked, did I believe you could, you know, could you handle your voices without meds? And I said, absolutely, positively, you can. Absolutely.
And you were fired.
And I said, they asked me, what did I believe? And I said, I believe you can handle your voices through other venues other than medication. I said, but it comes down to choice and helping somebody work through something, because sometimes it's just some kind of trauma going on, and you just got to be able to do that. And because this guy had been in and out of Kings County Hospital, all right, and the R building, okay, just about the
where we'll be June 19th from 4 to 6 p.m., holding a vigil in remembrance of Esmond Green, who was murdered there. Go ahead.
Right. And now when you go up, it's really scary now, Lauren, because when you go up to the Kings County building now, the outpatient clinic and the inpatient clinic are literally next door. It's only the reception area that separates them.
Well,
I mean, I had to go up there a couple times as a mobile crisis team member. And, you know, what
I can
tell you is when, what?
No, go ahead.
So what I can tell you is from the voice of experience, if a modality of treatment has a certain amount of liability built into it, and that team is not ready nor willing to take the risk that goes with that liability, you're screwed. I mean, the SUS respite here in Brooklyn, you're supposed to have 24-hour access. Everybody's supposed to be able to go in and out at their will. They didn't have it set up that way. They were in full breach of contract, SUS. And I got after them because I sit on the advisory board for the city for DMH. And I said, if you pay them, I'm going to have a real problem with this. Because they're in full breach of contract. People are supposed to be able to go in and out. I mean, that's what it because the way it was before, at least, they had just set up another institution inside the community. And that's problematic.
And a violation of creating a mental
patient, just kinder and a gentler way to do it.
Right. And Lester, I'm going to put you on the spot here because we had a big fight when you told me that you were taking this job. And anyway, I love you dearly. And Lester, for anybody who doesn't know, was one of the study coordinators of the D-Voice Research Project, and we work really closely, and we've been friends for decades. But we still had a really big fight about this. And you were so hopeful and passionate about thinking that you were going when you were taking. Would you talk about what it was like before? Because I think Raymond also, you brought this up in terms of what, you know, billing and the hope that, like, there would be some kind of validation to what was going on now and things. Lester, would you talk just a little bit about what you thought you were going to do and then your feelings about
that
it now?
My choice to go work for HHC had several factors involved, but the biggest one was the ability to try to change the culture of the mental health system, to make providers and help them to understand that, yes, they could take risks. We could treat folks like human beings. We didn't have to see them as cash cows. We didn't have to see them as raw commodity and material and basically tagging their ear and deciding which slaughterhouse to go to. that we could actually help people and have providers see that people go through ups and downs and all arounds just like they do. It's the difference is who has access to what and how do you handle that.
And then what happened within the first week?
Well, within the first week, I went to write a case note for someone, and I did it the way the open dialogue or the needs adaptive treatment model said, which is you never use the word patient or client. No derogatory terminology can be used in the note. So you're supposed to use words like person or something like that. And I wrote up the note the way the note's supposed to be written, and I got told point blank I couldn't do that because of Medicaid and billing and all that stuff. Hmm. So I went at it with my supervisor from the jump and turned around, and the compromise we made is I would use Miss or Mrs. or Mr. whenever I wrote about anybody because I refused to not see them as a person.
Now, let me ask you this, Lester. How are you a peer of somebody if you're writing a note on them?
I think the only way to truly do it, honestly, is to go at it from a positive aspect. Like, I'll give you an example. When I had to write up a note, and the providers on my team turned around and they wrote up this note and they complained, basically, and they talked about symptoms and epidemiology and all this other stuff. I wrote a case note that said that this gentleman had had enough of not having clean laundry, and so he chose to go out and do his laundry. And then on top of it, I said, but the problem herein lies that the father wants this young man to go out and get a life and get a job and do this and do that, but the father continues to enable him. He won't give him any kind of money, not even a travel, but he will when he turns around and asks him for cigarettes. The father is willing to give him cigarettes. Can't have it cut both ways. And when I would go at my team, the only place I ever came from was a social...
Oh, there's a lot of background noise. Sorry, if somebody is... Lester, I don't know if you're on speakerphone or...
No, I'm not.
Okay.
You know, I always came at it from a place of, this is a social justice issue.
It is a social justice issue, but my point remains, if you have power over somebody, and you're, even if you're there in an idea of being in a supportive role, but the end result is that this person could potentially get locked up or forced drugged in the community or something, and you're in a position of where you're writing quote-unquote notes on people, how is that a peer?
There's a difference between a peer and peer services. I think there's a difference between the industry and the movement. I think there's a difference between, you know, like the whole credentialing thing we're doing in New York State. I think one of the things I'd like to see, but Lauren, this is not your cup of tea in terms of research, but one of the things I'd like to see if credentialing leads to a place where quote-unquote the profession, so doing the work itself, becomes on par with providers, and we get left the fuck alone, basically.
Right,
to
but that's
do our job,
that's
and
what,
we're seen differently.
But that's what Raymond
not,
was saying.
And not necessarily
that's,
in our in,
and,
with our interactions but, with peers.
But that's what Raymond was saying, and that's not happening. So the further justification, and then this other issue, Raymond, that you brought up about that now that it's billable, that you can't just continue services with somebody, that this is, you know, or being a support role to someone. But I think, Lester, the point that you made that this is not the movement, this is an industry, is important for people to realize, and that people who are working in the industry can be involved in the movement, but people who are working in the movement generally don't survive very long in the industry. And so
no, we don't.
It's a real problem, and I think area code 845, your line is open.
Hey, Lauren, it's Anthony from Rockland. How you doing?
I'm good, thanks. How are you, Anthony?
I'm well. I'm just a little annoyed and angry today, and I just wanted to call the vent and give an AOT update.
Oh, would you please? And I'm sorry you're annoyed and angry. I was kind of hopeful there for a moment.
Yeah, no, it's all right. It's just that I had my AOT examination meeting today, and just for the listeners out there that have heard me calling about this, it's just an update. I was basically stunned by my psychiatrist today, absolutely stunned. He lied the whole time to my lawyer, and my lawyer was looking at me and looking at him, and we just knew we were catching him in lie after lie after lie, and she reviewed my chart, and on the chart it said it completely contradicted everything that he said. He told the lawyer, me, while I was there, that I was symptomatic again, that I was experiencing paranoia and hallucinations and voices and delusions, and I'm not. And in my chart, it clearly says three times that the consumer is experiencing and reporting no symptoms. He's, like, lying through his teeth. I'm just so...
In your medical
record. I'm just so
fed
up right now. My
wow.
chart, yeah. And this was after he told us, because the lawyer is legally able to review my records. He told her that she has to go through this whole process with the Commissioner of Health of Rockland County, and they have to go through this whole entire process. And she's like, "No, I don't. I'm legally allowed to look at his records." And then, I mean, long story short, she looked at it anyway, made photocopies, and it's just gonna. I know he's gonna lie on the stand because this is what happens. It's ridiculous.
Wow.
This is awful. And so do you have a court date at this point, or do you...
Well, the funny thing was all the paperwork for the court, for the petition, and all that paperwork they have to fill out was due today at 5 o'clock. Now, if it wasn't filed by 5 o'clock today, she's going to move to dismiss the case, and I may be able to get free of AOT, but I don't know. I don't know if they filed it by 5 o'clock. But if they did file it before 5 o'clock, the court date is probably going to be this coming Monday next week, I would imagine.
Okay.
It's usually on a Monday.
Yeah,
I'm just a little...
But this is that they're lying in your medical records and that they're lying to your lawyer. And so is there some way that, like, the conspiracy, the RICO Act that got brought up, that there is a conspiracy upon the medical doctor to misportray information in order to maintain the financial gains that they're getting from having you on AOT?
I don't know. I think you know what I think it is, and I went over this before when I called in a few weeks ago, was I really think that they're afraid if I leave they're gonna lose all the money my insurance company's paying out, because I was talking to a friend mm-hmm. of mine and she told me that she asked me, do you know what medications you're on? I was like, yeah, of course I do. I'm on the Abilify injectable once a month, and I'm on the oral once a day. And she said, she asked me, how much does it cost for the injection? The injection for Abilify is about $2,000 for the injection.
Whoa.
And I've been on AOT with the county for 2.5 years, so for a year, that's like $24,000. So that's like almost over $70,000 if you do the math. That's not counting the oral. The oral
right,
is like $800 a month.
See,
and then,
this is why I think that you've got a case under RICO, because this was just this case law that I keep looking at from the other day about the Racketeering Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act, and that there is a conspiracy to maintain the financial gains that they're getting by having you on these life-threatening drugs.
Yes.
And I think that I don't know if your lawyer would be interested, but I will I'll Facebook you this article so that you can pass it on, because this was between Eli Lilly and Connecticut and around Zyprexa, but it's the same kind of thing where people are getting financial gain from maintaining people, and that there's lying, this medical lying in your medical charts. This just seems to me to be something that is of deep concern to anybody, especially because of these electronic medical records that are coming.
Yeah.
This is just you know, where the medical records are taken as the same kind of facts that psychiatry is taken as facts, and that's just illegitimate. And so have you been keeping your own notes by any chance of where, you know, what you've been saying to the psychiatrist, or could you go back and reorder, you know, do you have, like, a journal or something where you can show, like, what they were saying versus what was actually going on?
Well, no, I didn't make a journal, but, like, everything in the chart, because we went over the chart today, and the stuff that was in the chart, like, from what I recall from my memory, what I told the therapist was, everything was accurate in the chart, but when he was talking to the lawyer today, he was contradicting what was in the chart. The chart was right, but he was...
Oh, I see. He's just, it's not that he's falsifying records, it's that he's just misrepresenting what's in the records.
Yeah, like he said that I was symptomatic, and in his own handwriting, three or four different times when I've seen him, because he's a new doctor that I'm seeing, he says no symptoms or not symptomatic. So because my lawyer asked him, well, because they want to renew it for a year, and the last renewal was only for 3 months, and she was like, well, why are you going to renew it for a full year after it was just 3 months? What's the reason? And he was like, oh, because we think he's symptomatic and we think he's going to have problems again.
Okay.
And then we went over the chart and just said no symptoms. So he's gonna lie on the stand. I know he's gonna, when he testifies.
So
I know he's gonna lie.
Isn't that perjury? I mean, isn't that like illegal?
Well, that's the thing, because if it's in the chart and it says he's experiencing no symptoms, and the most recent office visit was May 30th, about 2 weeks ago, and he lies on the stand, he's gonna get caught. It's over. I don't know what he's gonna say, but I have a feeling he's gonna lie, and I have a feeling that the judge is gonna side with the psychiatrist, because with my experience, that's what happens.
That's all they ever do.
Yeah.
All right. This is a lawsuit in the making on your side. I feel like this is just terrible that this is what's happened and how you've been lied to, because you were told that this was it. It was over. This was going to be the last go around. Right?
Yeah,
and
I was told.
And you've done everything that they've asked. You've complied every step along the way, and you've gone further and farther, and you've got yourself enrolled in school and all this other kind of stuff. There's so many positive things going on, and they're lying.
Exactly, Lauren. And you know what? It's just they've been like we've been talking about, like they've been telling me this last 3 month renewal was it. That was it. They were going to let it expire. I was going to be allowed to see my own psychiatrist. I was going to be able to see my own therapist, which I am on the side, but I have to pay out of pocket because the insurance won't cover it, because I'm seeing the court ordered therapist. And they were telling me, oh, once the 3 months are up, you'll be free. You'll be able to go on your out on your own. And then all of a sudden they hit me with this, and I'm like, and it's just ridiculous. It's ludicrous. It's ridiculous.
It's a crime. It's a crime against humanity. It's a violation of human rights. It's torture per the United Nations Special Rapporteur on the Convention Against Torture, and these people should be held legally and morally responsible for what it is they're doing. This is just tragic.
Yeah.
And then when he was talking to me, he was like, what are the positive things that a medication brings you, and what's the positive outcomes of having an injection? And then I told him, I was like, I'm not consenting to injection. I just take the oral medication. I don't want to take the injections anymore. And he's like, well, why don't you want to take the injection? It works better. And I was like, I wanted to tell him that these medicines are toxic and they're going to end up killing me and I'm going to die by the time I'm 50. There's a good possibility because my kidneys will shut down, my liver will fail. But I didn't tell him that. I was just like, listen, it's just I don't like needles to begin with, and I think it's invasive, and I think I could be trusted to take my own medication. And he's like, well, I don't think it's a good idea. I don't think it's a good idea. And it's getting frustrating. And I know he's gonna renew it for a full year, and it's just another year that I'm gonna have to have these medications going through my body.
Oh, man.
But wait a minute. Time out. Hold it. Can I say something?
Go ahead.
We know that there's research out there that says the more you medicate someone and the more you create problems within the neurotransmitters and the synapses, eventually the brain has to prune, what we call prune itself again, meaning it has to create those neurotransmitters and synapses, and that's what causes the relapse.
Mm-hmm.
And part of the problem is the medication, and when that happens, the medication is the problem. And so you can't be on these meds long-term. Anybody who knows the report from NAMSTED that says people with a psychiatric diagnosis die 25 years earlier, up to 37.5 years earlier than their non-diagnosed counterparts. And that's because of the drugs. The drugs encourage smoking because you've done and upset the neurotransmitters and the synapses in the brain. And so what happens is your brain gets to a point where it needs those synapses. It prunes itself, meaning it makes those synapses again, and that's what causes the relapse. It's during the time that they've got you on medication. You're supposed to be learning skills, how to cope with those voices, because we know for a fact that when people hear stuff, see stuff that most of us can't hear or see, 6 weeks tops, and they come back to us.
Yeah.
Or they come back to our reality,
think,
or what most people know.
And I think, like Raymond was mentioning before, also this issue of diabetes, metabolic syndrome, tardive dyskinesia, neuroleptic malignant syndrome, kidney, liver failure, thyroid problem, like all these physical symptoms that wind up killing people, and the drugs are causing diabetes, and nobody wants to address that, you know, who works in the professions as anything that should be of concern.
You know, if you got what's loaded for bear, in my opinion, then, and you're worried you got to take on the psychiatrist, then in my opinion, what you do is you look up Terry House, you look up Lauren Moses' work, you look up the NAMSTED report, and this way you give your attorney enough, what I call armor, to defend you, to get you out of this crazy crap.
Yeah.
Right.
Because in my opinion, the only quote-unquote, if I can, I'm having trouble saying it this way, and I don't know how to phrase it. It's too late at night. It works, supposedly, AOT, is because of all the social things that come with it. It's not the meds that work.
Somebody's got a lot of background noise. I think that, you know, when the issues are economic or spiritual or trauma-based or from resulting from oppression or you know, the things that happen to one in one's life, that you can't fix a economic problem with a pill. It's just not realistic. And at the same time, it's billions of dollars in taxpayer expenditures, trillions of dollars over time. Who knows how much it adds up to if you really sat back and added up all throughout time how much this fraud has costed the taxpayers. And people are being conditioned and lied to in the media to make sure that everybody thinks this is okay with us. This new study that Maria brought out today and called our attention to about the cortisol levels and correlations between quote-unquote depression in specifically in boys 12 to 19 years of age. Raymond, everything that you brought in, anytime you want to spend a significant amount of time or, you know, let anybody know specifically what's going on, I thank you for calling in and for alerting me to this issue about, you know, when it's not able to bill, you can't bill anymore, and so the actual whole service structure is also another issue in how it goes, and that people aren't being given any more respect because this is now a quote-unquote billable position. And I appreciate very much the people who work on the front lines and who are in those places where they're attempting to help people get out of being institutionalized and being subjected to psychiatry. And I think that with all the values issues that we have, that the ultimate thing that all of us and every one of us who called in tonight has gotten out of this system and been able to speak out. And for those of you who are listening who may want to call in the future, please do. If you have a idea for a show or would like to be a guest and spend an hour or two talking about the work that you're involved with or things that you've experienced in your life, or if you know of a news tip of a human rights violation that's being committed, you can call the Talk with Tenney tip line 24 hours a day at 718-273-8708, 718-273-8708. I want to thank you all for speaking out, and I'm going to ask you to keep on talking. Until next time, talk to you soon. Thanks, everybody.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Anthony, I'll talk to you offline about how we might be able to help.